We have a real treat today on Art Matters. We've got Eowyn Ivey and Eowyn's debut novel, The Snow Child, earned you a place as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, and it also became an international bestseller. And your new book, To the Bright Edge of the World, tells the story of a 19th century expedition into the Alaskan wilderness and a fictional river, the Wolverine River, which I understand is a lot like the Copper River, but we'll get to that in a minute. But I am so happy to have you here.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. This is my first time to Haynes. You know, until now, my main knowledge of Haynes was through your writing. So it's such a treat to actually be here now. It's wonderful.
Well, thanks. And I guess what I'd like to do always on the show is we have our guest introduce himself. So introduce yourself the way you want to be instead of the way I might. I did have to get the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's not something I normally just drop into conversation.
Yeah. So you're not wearing like a medal around your chest or anything. I would.
No,
maybe earrings or something.
I'm still in shock over it, I think, to be honest. So, no, so I'm Eowyn Ivey, and I grew up in the Matanuska Valley. We live about 70 miles northeast of Anchorage, and my husband and I grew up together in that small town. And it's really wonderful. I think one of the wonderful things about the books is that they've gotten me to see parts of Alaska that I've never gotten to see. So the first time I was down to Southeast was with the Snow Child, and this is my first time to Haynes. So I'm really excited to be here.
Right. And so Palmer, right? Aren't you a graduate of Palmer High School?
I am a Palmer High alumni. So is my husband and my oldest daughter. Our oldest daughter just graduated from Palmer High too. So we're a family of them.
And you also worked for the Frontiersman for a little bit?
I did. Yeah. So I worked at the Frontiersman newspaper coming right out of college. I had gone out of state to Western Washington University in Bellingham, and then I needed an internship to finish my degree. So the plan was I was just going to work at the Frontiersman for 6 weeks, long enough to satisfy my internship. Typical Alaskan story. About 9.5 years later, I was still there and had done every job, you know, reporter, covering all the different beats, photographer, page designer, the whole 9 yards. But then I ended up going to Fireside Books out in Palmer after that. So if you ever drive through Palmer, you've got to stop at Fireside Books.
Oh, it's a great bookstore.
It is. And although you have a wonderful bookstore here, too.
Yeah. It's really, we're lucky. Small towns.
You
and
are.
I've got one in Skagway, too.
Yeah. And that's one thing I do want to say, how grateful I am that Brenda down at Hearthside Books in Juneau sort of put the Southeast tour for me together. But working with all the independent booksellers and librarians, Sitka, Ketchikan, Skagway here in Haynes and Juneau. So I'm just grateful that they've put me up. They found places for me to stay and flown me and ferried me everywhere.
Hey, you know, I have a question for you because this comes up sometimes about, you know, the idea, the connection between writers and bookstores and writers and readers and, you know, that this is something you do, you know, for a living. Mm-hmm. How important is it to be in a part of the world where there are a lot of independent bookstores?
Oh, I think, I mean, I really believe that the Snow Child did as well as it did because of independent bookstores starting in the Pacific Northwest, in Alaska and Washington and Oregon. I mean, I really think because, you know, when you're just a writer from Podunk, Alaska, nobody knows who you are. And independent booksellers are so important in sort of this grassroots spreading the word about books. So I just have like endless gratitude. Plus, they're my favorite places to go every time. That's the problem is I always feel like I need an extra suitcase when I travel so I can bring all my books back.
So I have a question about The Snow Child, and I've heard this before that came from working at Fireside and reading fairy tales. And tell that story.
Yeah, and actually my standing joke with David, the owner right now, is that I'm going to have to, I don't work at Fireside Books anymore. When The Snow Child came out, I was just traveling so much. But I keep joking that I'm going to have to go back in there and volunteer to shelve books because that's where apparently all my inspiration comes from. So both novels were actually inspired by things I stumbled across shelving books at Fireside. In the Snow Child case, it was a little, you know, scholastic paperback fairy tale book called The Snow Child, illustrated by Barbara LaValle. A lot of Alaskans will know her art. And it was just this really, it was kind of the little paperback books your children bring home from the book fairs. You know, it was something you can really easily overlook. But I read it and I was just sort of taken over by it because it was the first time I think I had come across sort of a magical fairy tale that could have been set right in my backyard. And I abandoned a different novel that I've been working on for 4 years or something, and dove into the Snow Child. So yeah, it was. And then the same case with the new book. It was inspired by a report of an expedition from 1885. It was a rare edition that came in the bookstore that just I brought it home for the evening and just couldn't stop reading it. So
yeah. Now that's yeah. So it's called To the Bright Edge of the World.
The new one, yeah.
I'm sorry we're on radio because then you can't see the cover. It's just beautiful.
The cover is.
And both of them. Now, I've seen the cover, the English version and the American one, but it's really cool. It's a bird outline, and then
you can sort of see the mountains through the outline of the raven. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel, you know, and I think that sometimes is surprising to readers that oftentimes we get, you know, authors published by sort of the big five publishers often don't get a ton of say over our covers. And I have been so fortunate that if I've had concerns, they've listened to me. And mostly in general, I've just been thrilled with the covers. So, yeah, I'm very lucky that way.
But so that's the opposite. I'm not so thrilled. Oh,
it's
a moose and a lemon, but, you know, whatever.
I think you're covered. And I do think it's hard because I think your covers are beautiful. And I think that they are looking at a different thing than we are. I have these things like I don't want a tree in my on my cover that doesn't live in Alaska, and they're not concerned about that stuff. So far so good. I have to say the first cover that the U.S. came out with I didn't love, and they listened to me for the To Bright Edge of the World, and they came up with this other one, and I was like, yay.
Well, let's talk too, because there's a local connection in the actual expedition that you read here in Haines, and that expedition originally it was Allen, right?
Yes,
it was
Lieutenant Henry Allen. Yeah.
So explain this for us.
Yeah. So he. So it was a real expedition. And he started out because the Department of Columbia headquarters for the military at the time was in Fort Vancouver, right across the river from Portland. But then what they did is they came up the coast. In a big ship. And stopped in Sitka, and along the way going up, and then eventually got to Hinchinbrook Island.
Which is around Prince William Sound.
Yes.
Then,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And then had to kind of make their way across the Sound. And then go up the Copper River. And it was an amazing, I think what surprised me about it so much is what these men went through and survived. And they went up in late winter, early spring, before the Copper River broke up. And they went up over the mountains and floated out on the Tanana on the Yukon to the coast, living on, scraps of dead moose they had found. And it was pretty grim.
Pretty unprepared, really.
Very unprepared, yeah.
And you convey that now, and you chose, though, to make it fictional.
I did. So I fictionalized everything. I fictionalized the river. My character is Alan Forrester. So I use the name Alan just to kind of as an homage to this amazing journey this lieutenant did. But my guy is, a colonel. He's older. I gave him a promotion. Mm-hmm. I just wanted the freedom to have my own characters and not feel sort of held down by real people. I've read different historical fiction books that I've really enjoyed. About real people, but it makes me a little uncomfortable as a writer to try to step in, and imagine what this real person would have thought or felt. So this gave me the freedom to do whatever I wanted to do.
Right, right. And see, the local Haines connection is Mark Allen, who works in Art Harbor.
Right.
And people know he's related to the...
I had forgotten about that.
He's a descendant of the original... Lieutenant.
Exactly. I had totally forgotten about that connection. And actually, it's interesting because that actually is just an example of why I would have felt uncomfortable trying to tell the real Henry Allen story when there are people out there who are related to him that certainly know more about him than I do. And so by fictionalizing it, I can just kind of invent what I want to. But I love that there's some local connection. That's really great.
But what's interesting to me, too, though, you fictionalized it, but you... you make it seem so real because it's all a series of letters and then the illustrations that are the artifacts that look exactly like you'd see in a historical book.
Yeah.
And now, are those all fictional as well?
It's such a mix. So in some cases, they are actually photographs from the time. Some of them are one of them is a cabinet photograph that I bought on eBay. And some of them are photographs that I got permission from the Alaska State Historical Library to use. And others are photographs that I took that I had someone digitally age for me. There's real postcards and real old advertisements. So it was just fun. I know it seems like a strange thing that I did. What I wanted to do was fictionalize it, but then I wanted the reader to completely buy into it. I wanted it to feel really real to the reader so that they would maybe feel like they were opening this old trunk or crate and just sort of digging digging through and not really sure what they're going to find when they turn the page. But then hopefully in the end, it feels like a cohesive story.
And that's really the way that the whole novel unfolds. It's the old guy has the trunk right. of the all of the stuff from this expedition, and he's sending it up to a young museum curator in a town, a little town, a lot like Chickaloon.
A lot like Sutton, actually. It's so funny because my husband and I were caretakers at the Alpine Historical Park in downtown Sutton when we first
downtown
came back from
Sutton.
It's not much. You blink, you're going to miss it as you're driving through, as the saying goes. So parts of it are definitely, people who are from that area will recognize certain places and certain, you know, aspects of the town, I think.
But then, and then the way the whole book is structured is it's brave and it's tricky to do it because it's all in these letters or the reports back from the expedition or the official reports, mm-hmm. the journal entries, it's all told that way. And then there's the modern guys that go back and forth that are trying to wonder what's happened, and the story right. unfolds. And what I just loved about the book were the way you used language and the change in voice for each of those things.
Oh,
I mean, that's,
thank you.
It didn't sound the same.
Good.
And, you know, and especially, I mean, I just, for me, and maybe this is just because I just love Sophie.
Oh,
yay. The wife of the expedition leader who has such a big character, and she's not on the expedition.
Right, right. She would love to be on the expedition, but she's stuck back in Fort Vancouver with all the officers' wives and struggling that. Yeah, and that was something, I mean, I did do a lot of research just reading diaries and letters from wives of polar expedition leaders and different things, and the reports and journals of the people on the expedition to try to get the language right. Because that was something I felt like if I was going to do this, I didn't want to mess it up. I wanted to make it so that you were sure when you went from the colonel's diaries to Sophie's that you knew there was a change in voice, you know,
yes.
and it has to do with like sentence structure and word choice. And I became obsessed with the Oxford English Dictionary because every time I would stumble on a word and think, would they have used that in 1885? I could look it up online on the OED and see exactly when it had been introduced and how it was used. And so I became a little obsessed about some of the stuff to try to get it right because I didn't want to mess things up. I think it's kind of an illusion, you know, in fiction. It's sort of this dream that you hopefully allow a reader to step into. And I think when you get big things wrong, it can kind of shatter the illusion. And I've had that happen when I've read books about Alaska that get some little thing wrong. And I just didn't want to do that. So hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yeah, but the other thing about that is, though, as you're writing, do you find it then inhibiting? I mean, can you just sort of write along and then go back maybe later and double check? Or do you, you know, at what point does the research stop and the kind of the character take over?
Yeah, I think that it got easier as it went. So I think in the beginning, I was double checking more. But then I kind of got more comfortable with the voice. And then I would just sort of make a list of words that maybe I would check or, you know, but there were silly little things, you know, like I remember becoming just obsessed about what kind of chocolate they had in 1885, because there was references to chocolate being brought on the expedition. But I didn't know, is that like a bar shape or a square? Where, you know, like, and these little things that you can just spend way too much time digging around online and looking at old books. But the fun part is when I would go on these little searches, oftentimes I would stumble across something totally unexpected that had nothing to do with what I was looking for. And then that would just sort of enhance, hopefully, creating this world even more, I think.
So you're describing then a lot of research done, I'm assuming, from your desk via mm-hmm. the computer. So how do you, what's your setup? Where's your home? Are you rural? Are you, is your office in the house? And how do you work?
I owe so much to my husband because he's always been really supportive. And when we first bought, another kind of typical Alaskan story. We bought this recreational cabin in Chickaloon that was completely unfinished. The only electricity coming into the house was an orange power cord through the sliding glass door. No water, no running water, no plumbing, all this stuff. But when we first bought it, he said, up there on the balcony, I envision a library. And I was like, oh, I always knew I loved you. You know, so he has built me a library, and he has also built me an office upstairs that's where I go and work. You know, and with both my daughters now in school, and our oldest graduated, actually, my husband goes off to work every day. So I just work in my little office with my books, you know, at my fingertips. But I have to say that I was fortunate in choosing 1885, which was purely based on the expedition date. But because of that date, all the material, so for example, if a photography manual was published in 1885.
Right, and Sophie's a photographer.
Exactly,
so
yes.
There was a lot of photography stuff.
And I had to do a lot of research about it. But fortunately, a manual from that year is now out of copyright. So unlike Google Books, a lot of these have been digitalized. They've been scanned in. So I can pull up an 1883 photography manual and read exactly the terminology they use, what chemicals they were using. I don't know what writers did before the internet. I mean, you would have been like writing off to some library and saying, can you, photocopy some pages? And I don't know. I don't know how you would do it. So I also got to do a lot more like physical research that I, with the snow child, I really didn't do any research. But with the new book, I did a float trip on the Copper River, very much thanks to the Rasmussen Foundation. I got an individual artist grant to do that. And then I also went down to Fort Vancouver and spent several days there with my mom, actually, just sort of, just trying to experience what the place would have been like for Sophie when she was there for that year. So,
and does Fort Vancouver look at all like our Fort Seward?
You know, it does. It's funny you say that, because I was walking through as I was coming up here, and a lot of the buildings are very similar. There were a lot of similarities. It reminded me a lot. And then also just, the beautiful lilac trees and different things that are planted around, very, very similar to Fort Vancouver.
Yeah, I thought about that when I was reading it. I kept thinking, I bet this is like our fort. And then the laundry and some of the issues were very similar. It sounded like from what we hear about ours.
Yeah, and it was fun. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you have this issue as a writer, but I, as a newspaper reporter, I felt very comfortable saying, I'm from the Frontiersman and I would like you to interview you about this issue or this whatever. But as a novelist, it feels so weird. So I'm there at Fort Vancouver and I wanted to meet with the archaeologist and the historian, and I was like, I'm a novelist. is this a real job that I can make you spend time with? And they were so wonderful. They spent hours with me talking about the fort and telling me different things. So I've been trying to be braver about identifying myself as a novelist, like it's a real job or something.
I think at this point for you, it's a real job. I remember that Pulitzer Prize nomination.
Yeah.
just remember that.
I think none of it seems real yet, I guess. I don't know.
I think you're okay.